So last year, far-right organizations were at the head of mass protests in Australia for the first time in decades. Tens of thousands of people participated in, every major city participated in protests against lockdowns, against health measures, against vaccines. And for anybody on the left, I'm sure it was chilling to see streets of Australia covered in Donald Trump flags, people's, with QAnon insignias on them, the sort of Confederate flags, the Proud Boys, all of the symbols and organizations of the far right dominating the streets for months in Australia. In every city, these protests were organized by far-right figures. So just one of the most clear examples is in Melbourne. One of the main organizers was this guy, Harrison McLean, who didn't openly say that he was a Nazi, but in online discussions, he was found to be talking about how the far right figures in this movement had to be patient because not everybody was ready for the Jewish question, as he put it. Not everybody was prepared to accept anti-Semitism and neo-Nazism in the movement. So they had to be patient and try to radicalize the movement in this direction over time. Neo-Nazis in Australia oriented very consciously to this movement to try to grow an audience for far-right and fascist ideas. These were easily the largest far-right rallies in Australia for several decades. And they gave far-right and fascist groups a huge audience that normally they would never have in Australia to grow out of. They are much more sustained than any far-right protest movement in my lifetime as well in Australia. Since the government ended all health restrictions and allowed the virus to run rampant through Australia, the protests, anti-lockdown and COVID conspiracy protests, anti-vaccine protests, have massively declined. But this is not a reason to be complacent. For one thing, the movement obviously clearly gave an impetus to far-right campaigning in the elections in Australia. And, it was not seen as this triumph for the far right, but far-right parties in Australia increased their growth, their vote substantially in the federal election this year. So One Nation, Clive Palmer's United Australia Party, alongside a bunch of other far-right parties, the Liberal Democrats, they got a combined vote nationally of over 11% in the House of Representatives. And that is pretty terrifying, really. And also for people, a lot of us went and were campaigning for socialist politics in the election. And we all noticed actually the large number of, far right conspiratorial people campaigning for things like the United Australia Party. So it mobilized, the election mobilized these people to try to, argue their disgusting politics to the Australian population. And I think these networks are likely to provide the basis for future far-right activism in Australia. They've been supercharged by the anti-lockdown COVID conspiracy protests, funded by Clive Palmer, and we shouldn't expect that they'll just disappear totally from Australian politics. In the rest of the world, however, the situation is actually far, far worse than in Australia. Far-right parties, and in actually many cases, fascist organizations have built established bases of support in country after country. I don't have time in this talk to go through a huge amount of the examples. So there's a bunch of examples that I aren't able to touch on. So I can't talk about the situation in India, where there's a far-right government, in Brazil, a far-right government, in the Philippines, a string of far-right governments that have, all committed acts of violence against the general population and normalized extremely reactionary ideas. I'm mostly going to talk about Europe and the US, partly because it's, what I know about, but also partly because the politics of the far right in those countries are actually more influential to the far right in Australia. Far right parties, in Europe and the US regularly get substantial votes in elections. In some countries in Europe and the US, the far right has won elections and formed government. And in others, they've participated in coalition governments with traditional right-wing parties. They regularly get, 10 to 20% of the vote for quite extreme political parties. This is a terrible development for world politics. Many of these parties have ancestral or organizational links historically to explicit neo-Nazi and fascist groups. One example is I've got a list of them. The National Rally in France, which used to be called the National Front. the Brothers of Italy in Italy, the Sweden Democrats, the Freedom Party in Austria, and the Alternative for Deutschland in Germany. All of these parties have got either got their origins in like fascist organizations in their country, or they have a substantial faction within the party, like in Alternative for Deutschland, where they are open fascists. All of the parties I mentioned get between 10 to 20% of the vote, with the exception of France, where the far right almost won the presidential election and increased their vote pretty much every electoral cycle. In other cases, more traditional right-wing parties, more establishment bourgeois conservative parties, have increasingly radicalized towards the far right. So one example of this in Europe is Viktor Orban in Hungary, whose Fidesz party has become extremely authoritarian and radical and has used its power in government to try to undermine a whole lot of normal functions of a liberal democratic state. But probably the example that people are most familiar with is the Republican Party in the United States. So the Republicans have totally transformed, in the past 15 years or so, from a fairly standard right-wing capitalist party into a party increasingly dominated by far-right and radical politics. Since the election of Donald Trump in 2016, this has been supercharged, and most of the more moderate figures in the Republicans have been kicked out of the party or forced to toe the Donald Trump MAGA line. Really recent example of this was one of the few anti-Trump Republicans who openly criticized him, Liz Cheney, lost her seat in a recent primary election in the Republicans. It's not just the parliamentary party. The general sentiment that surrounds right-wing politics in America is increasingly radical. So Tucker Carlson, he's the most watched cable news presenter in America. He now pretty openly just promotes the Great Replacement conspiracy theory, which is developed by the far right. This theory basically argues that immigration is like a secret conspiracy to replace white people with non-white people. And incidentally, the modern concept of a Great Replacement conspiracy was developed by explicit like far-right fascist ideologues in France. But not just the Great Replacement, the far-right Republicans are more and more like hysterically campaigning against the supposed influence of Marxists in society, who apparently we secretly control the American government and the Democrats, and we're using that control to teach people about transgender ideologies and critical race theory. This is obviously a really insane conspiracy theory. Marxism, I wish we had that kind of power in America. So a totally insane conspiracy theory that's accepted by a large section of the Republican voter base. And just one other thing, opinion polls suggest that that still around 70% of the Republicans think Donald Trump won the election and it should have been overturned, the result. And 33% of the Republicans openly support the aims of the January 6th storming of the Capitol. That's millions of people. It's like 25 million people, actually, pretty like far right ideas are becoming massively normalized in America. And the rhetoric of that's adopted by the far right globally, I think, it shares a lot in common with far-right and fascist politics in the 20s and 30s. So in this time, fascist arguments centered around, extreme hatred of the left and workers, the workers' movement, trade unions, extreme demonization of migrants and, racial minorities, and a support for authoritarian state practices to destroy perceived people who are perceived to be undermining like the national values of whatever country. So it's not hard to see how these kind of themes are present in a lot of far right political discourse internationally today. I want to say two caveats to that though. We're not living through a direct like repeat of the 20s and 30s, and fascist politics today is not the same as like the Nazi Party or Mussolini's fascist party. For one thing, those parties grew in large part actually by organizing mass street movements that committed violence against the left. So the, you know, key period of growth for Mussolini's, you know, fascist party was organizing, you know, I'm talking about like tens of thousands and up to 100,000 people to basically riot throughout the countryside in Italy to, you know, beat up the workers' movement, kill trade unionists, you know, set union buildings on fire and shut down workers' struggle. And same with the, you know, the Nazis. A lot of their early growth depended on building, you know, street movements that were, you know, cohered around attacking the left and, you know, destroying, you know, any resistance to capitalism. So the far right in most countries doesn't have anything near the forces that the fascists had in the 20s and 30s. And I think that's important to say, just to have take stock of actually where we're at. It's a very, you know, terrifying situation. But the reality is that the far right has mostly grown over the past, you know, few decades by running in election campaigns and trying to present a more respectable mainstream face and being accepted into mainstream political discussion. So the probably the most influential example of this is the far right, you know, national rally in France. Again, they used to be called the National Front. Through they were, you know, in the post-war period set up by Vichy collaborators with the Nazi regime and, you know, explicit neo-Nazis. But in the post-war period, they realized that fascism had been, you know, open fascism and neo-Nazism had been totally discredited by, you know, the defeat of the Nazis in Germany. And so they went through a fairly conscious process of internal debate about how to respond to this situation. And they came to the conclusion that they couldn't build fascism in the same way as had happened in the 20s and 30s. So one, you know, person who was a, you know, associate of the founder of the National Front, Jean-Marie Le Pen. He was a fascist theorist in post-war France. His name is François Gaucher. And he argued that if the fascist flame is to burn again, it cannot burn in the same way because the atmosphere has been profoundly modified. So yeah, throughout the post-war period, they drop, you know, the attempts to build like, you know, violent street movements, try to focus more on electoral campaigns. And particularly from the 90s onwards, they try to distance themselves from open references to neo-Nazism. Instead, they adopt new terms to describe their political arguments. So instead of talking about, you know, Jews controlling the world, they talk about globalists and, you know, international bankers, you know, undermining the nation state, which these are all just, you know, fighting far right, you know, just a nod to saying, you know, the Jewish cabal and the elite, can, you know, same kind of fascist conspiracies. But they use coded language like this. They call the process de-demonization in France. Sometimes that's translated as detoxification. But I think the more literal translation is de-demonization. It's not that they wanted to actually make the party less toxic. They just wanted to make us that could be in a situation where they weren't demonized as much in general society. But they, you know, basically had massive success. The National Front, or now the National Rally, is probably the most successful European far right political party that comes from like a fascist origin, I guess. And as a result, they've been super influential throughout Europe. So I would say that, like, you know, the groups like Alternative for Deutschland, there are parties like a party called Jobbik in Hungary has basically adopted the same strategy of getting rid of its, you know, fascist paramilitary wing and just focusing on elections. A really clear example is the Sweden Democrats, a far right party that's, you know, gets around 17% in the last election. They actually introduced a rule in the 90s banning their members from wearing Nazi uniforms in public and had to expel some of their members for doing that. So, yeah, none of these parties are organized in the same way as like the far right in the 20s and 30s. But they do have an ultra reactionary project that's about increasing political acceptance for far right ideas and increasing, you know, support for authoritarian state practices. And, you know, there are some kind of partial exceptions for this. So Jobbik, the Hungarian party that I said, they used to have a paramilitary wing that would roam through the countryside and basically beat up Roma and any Syrian migrants in the country. really like, you know, quite explicit neo-Nazi kind of style violence. When they got dissolved their paramilitary wing and embarked on a process of de-demonization, they actually suffered a split, which there's now a new far-right party called Our Homeland Movement, I think. I kind of lost it in my notes. They're much more, you know, committed to the kind of street fighting fascist style politics. And they ran in the elections this year and got 7% of the vote, first time they ran in the election. So there's a clear base of electoral support for extreme far right politics. And I think the organizations of the far right are politically heterogeneous in this way. There are there's tensions and debates that exist within far-right movements about how much to present a, you know, more respectable mainstream face and how much to more emphasize radicalism and street movements. Sometimes this can lead to splits. Sometimes it can, you know, lead to, you know, moderation. But, I don't think we should assume that just because the far-right has not organized, you know, massive paramilitary by and large, that this situation could not change in the future. Yes, one other difference between the 20s and 30s is that when the far right has come to power, they have not created, total totalitarian dictatorships. So, Orban in Hungary is, a far right, authoritarian, but he hasn't been able to totally destroy liberal democracy and overturn elections. Similarly, Donald Trump in power, in many ways, was like a lot of the policies were pretty typical Republican policies. Tax cuts to the rich, nothing for ordinary people, putting profits before human life in the pandemic. But, you know, through his rhetoric, he was able to still encourage a growth in far-right sentiment, but not able to, actually overturn the results of the 2020 election, for instance. This is partly because, and it's another thing about seeing the situation we're in is different from the 20s, is that in the 20s and 30s, fascist and totalitarian regimes were built with the support of mainstream political parties and of the bourgeoisies in those countries. So Italy, Mussolini was, handed over power by the king officially and supported by huge sections of the business establishment in Italy. And in Germany, Hitler did not win through an election. He didn't come to power through an election. That's commonly said, but it's not true. He was handed power outside of an election cycle by a centrist bourgeois politician, President Hindenburg. So the situation is not that the far right is able to just totally transform the state if they come to power. However, they can encourage increasing violence and far right attitudes and activism. So I think Trump obviously did massively increase the prominence and popularity of groups like the Proud Boys, who do go around attacking, left wing protesters and trying to disrupt meetings of the left. As well as that, there's been an increase in, the membership of far right militias. They're nothing on the scale of the Mussolini and the Black Shirts and the Squadristi, but they are sizable organizations that, like the Oath Keepers, are estimated to have a few thousand members in America. But that's nothing like the 100,000 people in Italy in the 20s. So I think that's important to just figure out where we are. All these caveats are not about saying that that there's nothing to worry about. All of these developments are terrifying, actually, in politics. But I think one of the reasons to have those caveats is to say that when the far right comes to power, it doesn't preclude the ability of there being mass resistance to them. It's not like, in Germany, where Hitler literally just destroyed the workers' movement and successfully, created a state that was very difficult to build any resistance from in Germany. That's not the case. Countries that have far-right governments do have mass resistance and anger to them. So think about Black Lives Matter in America. Think about in Poland, the far-right government there tried to basically ban all abortions, and there's been general strikes to try and oppose these things. So we're not in a situation where, they can just destroy every element of resistance to capitalism. And so I think that means that, the fight continues to be extremely important and urgent. Okay, so left-wing organizations, I think, have to take very seriously the threat of the far right, try to understand where we're at and figure out ways to try to push back against the far right in Australia, but also around the world. And to do this, I think we first have to recognize and take stock of the extent to which the growth of the far right has been totally enabled by mainstream politics and capitalism. And there's a bunch of elements to this. For one, part of the reason for the growth of the far right is about the political crisis that's faced capitalism in the wake of the global financial crisis in 2008. And that combined with that, the European debt crisis, in the immediate aftermath of that. So far-right groups grew massively in this period because there was, massive social instability, massive anger at the mainstream political parties, because all of the mainstream political parties responded to these crises by attacking working class living standards, by, brutal austerity, destroying pensions, destroying, funding for healthcare in country after country. This is how, both centre-left and centre-right political parties responded to this crisis. This opened up space for a challenge to mainstream politics. And in some places, the challenge there was actually genuine left-wing challenges that emerged, like Syriza in Greece. I think, Jeremy Corbyn in Britain was a kind of a reflection of this, as well as Podemos in Spain. So the left can build, and we can build left-wing sentiment and challenges in this period as well. But unfortunately, in a lot of countries, it's been the far right that's been more organized than the left. To pose themselves as an alternative to the status quo, to try and benefit from, widespread racist sentiment, which is another actually element of how mainstream capitalist politics has welcomed the far right. Because the other way that mainstream governments responded to the global financial crisis was to increasingly demonize refugees and immigrants. So, country after country, take the Labour Party, Labour Party wants to run Australian capitalism in an uncertain, economic period. They don't want to give any reforms to working class people. So what do? They, try to change the subject by talking about how much they're going to lock up refugees. That's the Labour Party in Australia, actually. The concentration camps in Papua New Guinea were reopened by Kevin Rudd, not by Tony Abbott or whatever. Mainstream political parties have been discredited on economic questions and tried to use racism and nationalist sentiment to increase their political support. But in the end, they've ended up normalizing the nationalist and far-right politics of the far right. This has meant that the far right has totally been swimming with the stream in terms of like mainstream politics and discussion. Okay, so yeah. I think in particular, we have to start by recognizing the complicity of like reformist parties as well in the rise and welcoming the far right, or like liberal centrism in general in society. So, I mentioned Labour demonizing refugees. Well, it's not just, some other examples. In America, Obama deported more migrants than even Donald Trump could ever do in office. Obama massively militarized the borders. He, did nothing to help working class people. He gave $1 trillion to banks that caused the global financial crisis, while, millions of people were, had their homes taken away from them by the banks and forced into homelessness. If people can remember images from the start of last year as Biden was taking over, They're pictures of concentration camps on the American border that were now run by Biden, and the Democrats all defended this. Previously, they said this is basically fascism when Trump was doing it, but when they're in power, they say this is normal, this is okay, we have to do it, basically. All of this is a massive gift politically to the far right. Another really appalling example of this is in France, where the neoliberal centrist president Emmanuel Macron presented himself in elections as the defender of liberal values in France. What has he done, though? In the face of the yellow vest protests, he mobilized riot cops to attack working class people who were demanding, higher wages and a better life. Similarly, when there were mass strikes against his pension reforms, they basically tried to destroy the pension in France. Macron sent in the armed state, who he massively increased the militarization of. Not only that, the Macron government has massively adopted basically a lot of far-right rhetoric when it comes to Islamophobia. So a term popularized in France by Macron and not the far right is Islamo-leftism, which if people know a bit about German history, can probably see the comparison between that and Judeo-Bolshevism, which is what the Nazis argued was undermining German nationalism and had to be smashed in order to protect the supposedly glorious German state. So Macron is the person that popularizes the term Islamo-leftism to attack the far right. He's shut down, plenty of mosques in France, accusing them of being, non-French or, terrorist or whatever, with very little evidence, basically no evidence in most cases. So I think it's important that we start out by looking at the complicity of the mainstream capitalist politics in the current situation that we're in. Because if we want to take really seriously the question of how to fight the far right, we cannot support the people who've led the way to the far right. That might seem a really obvious point, but for large sections of the left internationally, it's not, unfortunately. So, large sections of the left and generally liberal, opinion basically argued we all have to stop criticizing Macron and campaign for him in the elections to stop the far right from winning. Similarly, in America, in the last election, there was, countless leftists and a lot of self-identified socialists argued that we couldn't criticize Biden right now. We have to campaign for him and his political platform because that's the only way we can stop Trump getting back in. There was even a kind of pathetic and humorous campaign called Settle for Biden, which was created by Bernie Sanders, former Bernie Sanders campaigners and part of his campaign apparatus. They argued you might not like Biden, but we have to stop criticizing him and campaign for him against the threat of the far right. Another example of this is a figure in Britain called Paul Mason, who's quite well known on the left. He was formerly a Trotskyist in like the 70s, now a very well-known Guardian columnist and left-wing writer. He argues that that in order to fight the far right, socialists and the left should resurrect a strategy called the Popular Front, and he describes it in very explicit terms. Socialists have to ally with sections of the bourgeoisie in order to prevent the rise of the far right. And that's what that policy was. It was implemented by the Communist Party, the Stalinist Communist Parties across Europe in the 30s as a supposed strategy to prevent the rise of the far right. Every time it was applied then, it was an absolute disaster. So there were Popular Front alliances in France and Spain, shortly after these alliances were made. In France, a Vichy government the French bourgeoisie decided to collaborate with the Nazis and smash up the left and the union movement. And in Spain, the majority of the bourgeoisie that the Popular Front argument said we should ally with ended up supporting a right-wing authoritarian military dictatorship led by General Francisco Franco, and massacres of the left and workers' parties. So yeah, total disaster whenever this strategy has been implemented, because in order to have an alliance with the bourgeoisie, the Popular Front argument says you have to moderate your criticisms of the bourgeoisie and stop trying to fight against capitalism. Explicitly, this is the argument that Paul Mason makes and what the Stalinists said in the 30s. We have to stop talking about revolution, stop talking about totally getting rid of capitalism and destroying, the ruling class. Instead, we need to ally with the ruling class to prevent the rise of fascism. A totally lunatic strategy from the beginning and led to disaster after disaster. And, when you think about the Settle for Biden campaign, what the fuck has Biden done to stop the far right in America? He's done nothing to try to prevent the Supreme Court from overturning abortion rights. He, you know, like I said, still runs concentration camps on the border. The Biden, instead of doing things that fight the far right, he's adopted a lot of the same rhetoric and policies that the far right advocate for. So Biden, you know, since coming to power, has championed the increasing of funding for the police and the security repressive elements of the state in America. And he's increased threats of war against China. In many ways, the imperialist tensions, the Biden imperialist kind of rhetoric that Biden adopts attacking China, is just a pretty straight continuation of a lot of Trump's rhetoric and his kind of policy of aggression towards China. So yeah, he's also done nothing to improve the lives of working class people. Most working class people's living standards are being totally trashed right now in America. And as a result, Joe Biden is now, at this point of his presidency, the most unpopular president of all time. So he's less popular at this point in his presidency than Trump was at the comparable point of Trump's presidency. This is because, you know, like, what the fuck could any ordinary person get inspired about with Biden? Literally offers nothing but increased inequality, you know, authoritarian violence, and, you know, whatever, doing nothing to stop, you know, the winding back of civil rights across the country. Yeah, and, you know, as well, you know, in terms of like whether or not Biden could have stabilized things, since Biden's election, and despite the many people who were arrested, who had participated in the January 6th protests, the number of Proud Boys chapters in the country has actually doubled in the last year. And that year, it was doubled from the year before. So there, yeah, the far right and, you know, violent sections of the far right and street movements associated with them are going nowhere, you know, as long as Biden remains president. In fact, they're growing. And Republicans are, you know, almost certain to just win the midterm elections at the end of this year. So the core of the problem is that mainstream capitalist politics has created the far right, or laid the basis for it to emerge and grow, and welcomed it into public discourse, normalized its key ideas. And so if we actually want to fight seriously against the far right, we can't be a part of this political project. Capitalism as a social system in general requires, you know, authoritarian state violence. It requires, you know, militarized borders. It depends on imperialist competition and war. And so, you know, to fight against these sorts of ideas that have normalized and, you know, helped the growth of the far right, well, if we want to fight against these ideas, we can't associate ourselves and be a part of, you know, bourgeois alliances, and we can't aim to just running the capitalist system. In the long run, we have to build movements independent of the bourgeoisie, not allied to them and not, you know, tied to them politically. We need to, you know, build organizations that can confront the far right and their politics in broader society. So I think, you know, in this, socialists argue that, you know, we will work with anybody to build street movements, to beat back racism, and to fight, you know, for a just society, an equal society. But we will not tie ourselves politically to reformist projects. We won't, you know, give up our political critique of capitalism in order to supposedly have a broader alliance just to defend against, you know, the more extreme versions of capitalism. Yeah, so I think part of the fight against the far right is actually building up anti-capitalist politics. That's not all of it, but I think that is a big part of it, because in the long run, you know, masses of the population are dissatisfied with the status quo of politics. And we're not going to, you know, I think the task of socialists is to try to harness that anger to smash the system, not to, you know, stabilize it and, you know, try to prevent it from becoming, you know, in crisis or whatever. So I would argue that other elements of an anti-fascist strategy, well, I think where possible, socialists and the left and anti-fascists should directly confront far-right politics where it's possible. So, you know, if the far-right are having rallies on the street, the far-left should attempt to or aim to build up opposition to them on the streets. And that's crucial for a number of reasons. One reason is that it prevents the far right from feeling triumphant about their meetings and rallies. If left-wing activists can outnumber them, and, you know, put them to shame and, you know, show that there's opposition and that people know what their politics represent and we don't want it. If we can do that and try to demoralize the far right, that can play a role in beating back their organizations. There are some other examples, some examples of this, some of that I was involved in Melbourne, actually. So in 2015, there were a series of far-right rallies around Australia. They weren't as big as the rallies last year, but they were sizable, a couple of thousand in Melbourne and, you know, similar in a bunch of other cities. They were called the Reclaim Australia rallies. All of the radical left in Melbourne basically, you know, worked together to build protests to try to disrupt their rallies, stop them from being able to march down the street. So we stood in their way of their rallies, and we tried to outnumber them. And we successfully did that, at, you know, pretty much every single time. There are a series of these rallies, and every time we outnumbered them, you know, 2 or 3 to 1. And that, you know, that really split those rallies, because a lot of the people in that those rallies were, you know, not necessarily fascists, although there was, you know, fascists at the core of organizing these rallies. But they weren't super hardened, a lot of the people at the rallies, and they weren't prepared to just keep coming out and get smashed and outnumbered and humiliated by the left every, you know, protest. So the rallies got smaller and smaller, and the far right groups that organized them basically splintered and went into crisis for several years. This is a pretty small example. I think it's worth saying, like, you know, for this is these are like, you know, far right politics that were way, way smaller than what exists throughout Europe and America. But in places in Europe, there are also examples of mass resistance putting the far right on the back foot, and in some cases, destroying their organizations. So I think the best example of this is in Greece. I haven't really talked about Greece before, but there was a very explicit neo-Nazi group in Greece called Golden Dawn. They got around 7% of the vote. They had a huge amount of support from the, you know, cops they got actually the most of their vote from cops in Greece. They had support of some, you know, extreme right-wing capitalists in Greece that wanted the thugs in Golden Dawn to smash up any strikes that happened in their workplaces. So they were a really serious threat. Got 7% of the vote, had a number of representatives in parliament, and would regularly attack migrants, as well as, like, you know, try to disrupt strikes and destroy left-wing resistance to Greek capitalism. So at a particular point, there was a huge campaign that emerged in Greece, organized mostly by radical leftists and anti-capitalists, but it included really broad layers of society as well. And this was in response in particular to Golden Dawn killing a left-wing activist, Pavlos Fissas, who's a left-wing anti-fascist rapper and activist. After the murder of Pavlos Fissas, there was, you know, mass protests on the streets, regular protests outside the offices of Golden Dawn, regular harassment of anybody supporting, you know, Golden Dawn, wearing their insignia or whatever, all throughout society, a mass movement basically against the far right and fascists. And this led to, you know, it made it really hard for Golden Dawn to operate in the ways that they normally were. It made it really hard for the mainstream media to cover Golden Dawn in a way that they would normally cover them as like a far right, you know, nationalist group. They had to much more explicitly call them out as Nazis. And ultimately, it put pressure on, you know, the government, who had been ignoring a whole lot of like the basically violent crimes that had been committed by Golden Dawn members. And there was a, you know, mass movement demanding that these violent criminals should be jailed for murdering people. And ultimately, the whole organization, on the brink of a, in the wake of a mass movement demanding justice, the whole organization was declared illegal. That was a real fight, actually, because the state prosecutors initially tried to avoid sentencing Golden Dawn at all. And actually, just before that verdict, the state prosecutor in Greece said, we recommend to not send any of these people to jail, even if you find them guilty or whatever. But at the same time, there were hundreds of thousands of people rallying across Greece, and, you know, thousands and thousands outside the courthouse. And that put pressure on the judge, even when the prosecutor that was meant to fucking be the person charging Golden Dawn said, don't put them in jail. They, you know, from mass public pressure, those people were locked up, and the organization of Golden Dawn is basically, you know, doesn't exist anymore in Greece. That's a really fucking cool story. Took a lot of dedication from radical anti-capitalists who worked with other, you know, political forces, but never tied their politics to, you know, bourgeois centrist politics. never strayed from being radical and demanding your street activism and struggle on the streets to fight the fascists. And tried to build an alternative vision of society. These protests were organized by radicals, by socialists. There are a bunch of different socialist groups in Greece that were involved in this. There are people who had a different vision of society. They had a vision of society that doesn't involve accepting the capitalist status quo, that's about, borders, war, racism, oppression, inequality, women's oppression. They had a vision of a different society that was based on human need. I think that is the sort of politics that can guide you to a real anti-fascist strategy. And that's why I think socialist politics are very, very important in fighting against the far right. And I don't have time to go into any of the history really, but it was the same thing in the 40s and 50s. It was only radicals and anti-capitalists and revolutionaries that would consistently fight against the far right. And so I think we have to, lessons to draw. The far right grows out of the decay of capitalist politics. Capitalist politics in crisis, radicalizing authoritarian state. This is the basis on which capitalism, and the far right, sorry. This is the basis on which the far right grows. In order to fight them, we can't protect the capitalist system. We have to fight against it. We have to be separate from the people who want to defend capitalism. And we have to build radical street movements that confront the far right organizations, but also fight against all of the ideas that are already existing capitalist society that have led to the situation that we're in now. So yeah, that's what I think we have to do basically. And hopefully people found that useful. I'll leave it there.